I think we'll just start. So just a little bit of by way of introduction about how this talk is going to work and how it has evolved. Somewhere in the literature, this is listed as a top 10 papers. And Dr. Dooley, Philip, and I have done this talk at different conferences. And so when we do the domestic side, it's kind of easier to rank what are the top 10 papers. You can see what ones have had the biggest impact in primary care. When we go to global health topics, it's a little harder to have objective data about that. And so we have just selected 10 studies from the past 5 years that we hope and we think will stimulate changes in how medical missionaries practice medicine, both here in the United States and abroad. So that's kind of the non-scientific method of how these papers were selected for this talk. That's very different than when we do papers focused only in the States. But before we start, I just thought it would be important for you guys to know who's speaking today in front of you. So I'll let Dr. Dooley introduce himself first.
Phil Dooley, I'm a family physician and the program director of Via Christi Family Medicine in Wichita, Kansas.
And so also by way of introduction, we're going to start recruiting if people to know for advertisements. Both Dr. Philip and I are both also involved with a sub-ministry of CMDA called CMDE. And so if you know people who are working overseas, we actually run a CME conference for healthcare-related missionaries that alternates every year between Thailand and Greece. And so if you know of anybody who's on the field, they should know about that conference because God has really used it in powerful ways. So my name is Jeff Lehman. I'm also a family doctor. And up until December of last year, I was a program director at a residency and currently working in an ER and then involved with missions in short-term ways in different ways. So that's by way of introduction. I think anything else we need to talk about? Okay. So the first paper that we're going to talk about was a paper published in Lancet Global Health 2 years ago. And what they did, the big question is this was, you know, many times if you've been working, first of all, how many people have actually had at least short-term experience or long-term experience working overseas? Okay. And how many of you have had at least some brush with patients who have seen traditional healers? Okay. And so, you know, sometimes we in mission hospitals bemoan traditional healers and all the bad things that they're telling our patients and doing to our patients. But in Uganda, in rural Uganda, they thought, does actually engaging with traditional healers improve rates of HIV testing and treatment of HIV in rural Uganda? And so this was a mixed method study. We'll talk a little bit later about what that means, but basically it was a quantitative and qualitative study. And so they were identified and people referred to, each district was referred to either referral, like these doctors were trained just to do their normal practice, which is if they saw someone that they suspected was at high risk for HIV, they would refer them to the center where they could get tested, versus training them to do the testing themselves. It was an oral point of care test. And they were assigned in clusters with 500 seronegative patients who have not had an HIV test in the past 12 months, but who are sexually active and who are receiving some kind of medical care. And so just think about this. These are really high-risk people that should be getting HIV testing. And so what they were looking for in this paper were what the primary outcome was, people who actually got an HIV test within the last 3 months. And then at the end of that, they did some qualitative interviews. So what did they find in this paper? They found that in the intervention group, 100% of all those 250 participants were tested for HIV versus only 23% of the control group. So if you were relying on this traditional practitioner to refer someone to go get HIV testing, it only happened about one out of every four times. But if you were training the traditional healer to do the HIV testing there themselves, 100% of those people got it. So there's overall, when you kind of accounted for clustering effect, there was a 77% increase in the testing uptake, and that was very statistically significant. But even more importantly was that 70% of the people in the intervention group who were tested and who were positive were actually linked to getting antiretroviral therapy. So not only were these healers now doing testing, they were actually now referring on for antiretroviral therapy, which was really, really an important thing. But the other exciting part was just to hear what the patients themselves were saying. So some of the clients, I just picked two of the quotes from the qualitative study here for the sake of our slides. He said, "Personally, I found the HIV test easier because it was someone that I knew and trusted, was the person delivering the test to the patients." And another person said, "I used to fear so much going for HIV testing to the big hospital. I would get so frightened and feel desperate. When I participated in the study with the healer, I was counseled, made to feel comfortable to receive an HIV test, and that I would receive the results, whatever they came out." And so this study, I think, showed pretty conclusively for such a small population of only 500 people that including these people, these traditional healers are ubiquitous in so many settings that we work, that by engaging them in the screening of HIV, not only improved the uptake of testing, but also helped, once people were diagnosed, to get antiretroviral therapy. So I don't know, Philip, what do you think?
So I think what we neglected to mention is one of us will present a study, and then the other will provide some commentary or some evidence-based medicine teaching points or something like that. So we're going to be going back and forth the whole time. The top-line thing for me on this is I really love mixed-method studies where you combine the quantitative data collection and the qualitative, because if all you have is the numbers, then you kind of know what happened, but you don't necessarily know why it happened. And so you're just guessing and making assumptions, whereas this, when you throw in that qualitative component, you can actually talk to people and get a better understanding of the why behind the what that you're seeing in the data. One drawback on this from a quantitative standpoint is no one in the control group tested positive for HIV. So when you have zero in one of the groups, you can't necessarily calculate an effect size and things like that. So that's just one kind of drawback. If this was a little bit bigger, you could get a better idea comparing, for example, ART initiation rates between the studies. But overall, really pretty simple and a great way to partner with individuals. I think the other thing that has come up, as we've talked about this in other places, from a medical missions residency training perspective, is sometimes we will set up dichotomies in the residents that we're training of Western medicine versus whatever their local medicine, their traditional healthcare system, and it sets up this cognitive dissonance that tries to make one better than the other. And so this is a nice way to help bring them together and use the resources that exist in the community already to try to make a bigger difference.
One other thing that I'll just mention is for the 10 years that we spent in India, the first five felt like we were combating traditional healers. And then the last five, we started inviting them to our campus, providing them with meals and just doing basic education, allowing them to sign orders, referring people to the hospital. So they felt like that they were kind of, it elevated their status a little bit, and it was amazing the quality of treatment of these people over time that we saw by partnering with them instead of seeing them as adversaries. And so just wherever you end up, just it's something to consider. Yeah.
So our next one is looking at using aspirin for the prevention of preterm birth. So our question there is, does starting daily low-dose aspirin in the first trimester of pregnancy prevent preterm birth in nulliparous women in low- and middle-income countries? So 14 to 40-year-old women between 6 and the end of the 13th week of pregnancy, almost 12,000 women, 40% in India, but also in Central America and Africa, with a singleton pregnancy, no more than two previous first trimester losses, and otherwise uncomplicated pregnancy up to that point. And they were double-blinded on baby aspirin daily or a matching placebo. They were seen every 2 weeks. They did pill counts to measure compliance and make sure they were actually using it. And the primary outcome was delivery at or after 20 weeks but before the 37th week. And they used a modified intention to treat analysis that excluded 418 women. A lot of these were losses before 20 weeks. 59%, 20 to 29 years old, 91% it was their very first pregnancy, 74% vaginal deliveries. The primary outcome was improved, so relative risk 0.89 there, about 2% absolute risk reduction, which gives you a number needed to treat of around 50. And all of the secondary outcomes were also kind of leaned in favor of aspirin. So you didn't have massive increases in hemorrhage or other issues there. And there were actually also just barely statistically significant improvement in perinatal mortality. And then they looked at early preterm delivery, less than 34 weeks, and there was an even bigger benefit there. So the conclusion from this study was that low-dose aspirin does reduce that risk of preterm birth by 11% in nulliparous women with a singleton pregnancy in these low- and middle-income countries. So a pretty cheap, low-risk intervention that could make a pretty big difference.
Yeah. I don't know how many of you provide prenatal care here, but it's crazy how much we use aspirin now in pregnancy, at least even here in the United States. How many of you attended the talk on evidence-based medicine hype versus that Dr. Bert Lee did on Thursday? So one of the things that he talked about in that lecture was the fragility index of like how fragile is this data. And we learned in that lecture that most studies have a fragility index of 2 to 3. That means if 2 or 3 outcomes would have changed to the other group, that it would no longer be significant. And that, you know, anything over 20 is very good. The fragility index of this study, I think, was 18 for the primary outcome. So really high quality evidence that this does matter. And, you know, even though you look at that and say, well, the relative risk reduction was only 0.89, or the relative risk was only 0.89, that doesn't seem like a huge effect. But you think about that, we're talking about an aspirin a day just for the duration of pregnancy. So it's a very, like Philip said, a very low-cost outcome and very low risk for just a short 9 months of being on pregnancy in healthy young people. So I agree with this. It's a huge improvement of cost-effective intervention that not only that improves preterm births, but also preeclampsia is the main reason why we're using it here. So, all right. So the next paper has been referred to actually in another talk by Dr. Raja in the mental health lectures, if you were attended that. So this researcher, Dr. Rahman in Pakistan, this is his third publication of looking at using lay community health workers so this is in a post-conflict setting in Pakistan. It was a randomized controlled trial. And the question was, can community health workers be effective in reducing anxiety and depression in a rural, conflict-ridden area of a lower middle-income country? And so if you think about this, this was done in the Swat area of Pakistan that was a part of a lot of the fighting along the Afghan border with the Taliban for almost 20 years. And even since the time that open fighting has stopped, there have been skirmishes, the infrastructure, 50% of businesses were destroyed. This area is literally a war-torn country. And so what they were looking at in the middle of this was for women living in rural areas with very little to no access to mental health services, could you train community health workers to provide interventions? And so this was done by community clusters, so there are lay health workers who work in each cluster, and so they took the cluster for each one of those health workers and they randomized them to either this intervention that we'll talk about or usual care. The one thing is remember is that most of these people are completely illiterate. They cannot read, right? And so how are we educating them? We'll talk about that in a second. Very few people were lost to follow-up. You can see that 94 or 95% of those people were included in the analysis. They did not count in this women who were either psychotic or had severe cognitive impairment who were at imminent risk of suicide. These had to be kind of functioning people at a community level who are greatly affected by anxiety or depression, but not suicidal. And so what was the intervention? The intervention was a World Health Organization. This is not in-depth counseling. This was a World Health Organization called Problem Management Plus. It's an intervention that the World Health Organization has developed. A very simple step-by-step education that's done over 1 week of 2 hours a day for 5 days with groups of women. And so they meet in these community health settings in the lay health workers' apartment. And who's teaching them? The intervention people are people who have a college education but who are not mental health professionals and who have been trained. And their training was a several-hour training that was done over 1 week. And there was a lot of stuff they did for quality control to see whether these people actually got the training that they were sharing and whether they were any good at it. And then once they were assessed to be good, then they were put into the community to do this teaching. And so they're all females, and that's why sometimes you'll see LHW, lady health workers. And so what did they find? They found out that the women, so let's talk about usual care as well. So what was usual care? These were still community health workers who were working in the community, who could learn to recognize people who were depressed or anxious, and then refer them on to the local community health center. So there's already some level of intervention happening with usual care. The intervention was a much more robust education and treatment, counseling. And so what we found out was that at 3 months later, the women in the intervention group had significantly lower scores on this HAD score, which is a great measure for anxiety and depression overall. And then individual scores for anxiety and depression were also improved, and there were no adverse outcomes that were discussed in this or that were reported at all in this. And so at 3 months after the intervention finished, there continued to be significantly reduced rates of both anxiety and depression in this rural area where mental health care was very, very challenging to find. And so I'll stop there, and then I'll mention that last point here in a second.
Sure. So a couple of things. Whenever you see a scale with some kind of point improvement, one of the questions you want to ask yourself is, how big is that scale? So is this a 4.5-point improvement on a 1,000-point scale? Well, that might be statistically significant, but it's pretty clinically irrelevant. This is actually a 21-point scale, so that's a pretty good, robust improvement. Like Jeff said, it's individuals that didn't need a ton of training, so it should be scalable. And this has also been reproduced in a lot of different settings. There's over 27 randomized controlled trials that have showed benefits from this kind of brief intervention without a pill. So that's the other thing. Not everything requires a pill to be treated. And so this is a nice intervention showing robust benefits. And in another talk, we heard about this being combined with a community health evangelism model. So we can get out there, use this evidence-based intervention for anxiety and depression for individuals who've suffered from trauma in these conflict-ridden areas, combine that with community health evangelism, also bringing them the gospel. And we've already heard about people implementing that model. So this definitely should be in the toolbox of anybody who's working in these areas.
And I don't know if any of you were able to go to Dr. Raj's talks. He's given three different talks here, but he's a psychiatrist from India. And basically, they're doing this in the mountains of North India, this type of training. But just to show you that these studies here that Philip mentioned, these 27 randomized controlled trials, included conflict-ridden areas such as Syria, Iraq, Indonesia, Uganda, Burma, Pakistan. You can see there, I don't need to read the rest of those. And so this was a really simple intervention with a big impact, because we all of us know that in the developing world, the number of trained psychologists or psychiatrists are really, really low, and that by partnering with community health workers, you can make a significant impact.
All right. Our next study is looking at when can you potentially transition from IV to oral therapy for certain serious systemic infections. This study was a systematic review and meta-analysis, 20 randomized controlled trials and a quasi-RCT looking at osteomyelitis, bacteremia, and endocarditis. You can see 4 to 8 trials in each of those. For osteomyelitis, those ones were all in adults. They generally excluded the axial infections. 4 trials did include infected orthopedic hardware. For bacteremia, there were 7 studies of adults, 2 in kids, 1 in only neonates. But gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria from many different sources. And then for endocarditis, those were only trials of gram-positives. But a mix of native valves, prosthetic valves, and infected pacemakers were actually included in the largest trial as well. One big issue is that they didn't do a formal assessment of trial quality or bias of the studies before they combined them for meta-analysis. And then everybody, except in one trial, everybody started on IV therapy and transitioned to oral therapy after 0 to 14 days. So what did we find? Generally, for osteomyelitis, it was pretty equivalent. For bacteremia, you had improved outcomes, so treatment success was your primary outcome. It was better, but not statistically significant for bacteremia. And for endocarditis, you actually had improved outcomes with the earlier switch to oral therapy. They did do an analysis for publication bias, but they didn't find any of that. So based on this study, it could be reasonable to do a step down from oral to IV instead of, you know, the paradigm here is all IV therapy for the entire time. So based on looking at the studies, what the inclusion criteria were, putting all the protocols together, said if your patient is clinically and hemodynamically stable, source control has been achieved, so that was universal across all of the studies. If there was an infected source, that was drained, removed, etc., before they considered switching, and their blood cultures were negative. Obviously, they need to be able to tolerate oral antibiotics, and that there has been a trial of whatever regimen is out there, and there's no other reason why you'd prefer IV, that this could be reasonable, help get people out of the hospital more quickly, get an IV out. Like, you look at that endocarditis, you know, having an IV in for 6+ weeks is not a benign intervention. So potentially being able to get rid of that indwelling access point is potentially why you actually saw better outcomes in some of these trials.
And for those of you who have worked in a mission hospital, how much success do you have keeping a patient in the hospital for 6 weeks? It just doesn't happen, right? People just cannot afford to be gone from their jobs and from everything that long. And, you know, that's the course of treatment for most acute osteomyelitis or endocarditis, is 6 weeks of IV antibiotic therapy. And so this is a really huge, if this is true, this is a huge potential plus for us that we can de-escalate very quickly to oral without harming our patients. The problem I have with this trial is that all the papers that they included in their meta-analysis, they didn't go through and evaluate each one of them to see whether they were good trials or not. So a good systematic review and meta-analysis will do an assessment of bias of every one of the papers to see how good they are. They did not do this. The other problem they did was that they only searched in the English language papers, which is not great, and that they only searched one database that's out there for studies. And so this is not the best way. This is certainly not a Cochrane review. This is not the best way to conduct a systematic review and meta-analysis. So the quality of this overall paper was not great. And so this, but what happens to me was when I read something like this and I say, okay, this systematic review, if this is true, this could be groundbreaking and changing for the lives of our patients. I don't like the quality of this paper as much as I wish I did. So then I just have that on my radar and in my search list for whatever search engines I'm using to look for papers, start looking for other evidence in this realm. And I will tell you, at least for osteomyelitis, there have been increasing numbers of papers looking at prolonged courses of oral antibiotics for osteomyelitis. In this study, they excluded axial, which means the spine. There have recently, in the last 6 months, been two papers looking at trials of oral antibiotics for spine osteomyelitis as well. So just something to keep your radar out. This is not the end-all, be-all paper, but really an important intervention if this does prove to be true. Anything else on that you want to mention? Let me check my notes. I'm getting old here, so I just want to make sure that...
I guess I would just say any meta-analysis is garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
So that's the important part of doing that trial assessment quality, is if you put junk in, it doesn't really matter what it shows on the back end. It's unreliable. So that's why you really want to see that quality assessment.
How many of you feel comfortable reading a systematic review and meta-analysis and assessing the quality of a systematic review and meta-analysis? How many don't feel comfortable doing that? I'll raise my hand too. To me, learning to understand and interpret a systematic review and meta-analysis is probably one of the most important things that we can learn how to do, because they are way more impactful than any randomized controlled trial, right? We want to see randomized controlled trials reproduced over and over again. And so this is the highest level of evidence. And if you can't remember how to do this, which I can't, there's a great website called CEBM, Center for Evidence-Based Medicine. And on there, they have checklists of tools. And there's a form on there that you can go on there and download. And it's a step-by-step checklist of how to assess the quality of a systematic review and meta-analysis. And they'll ask, how many reviewers were there picking papers? How many of them incessantly the quality of papers? And so it's a great resource to have. If you like me, can't remember all the steps of how to assess a systematic review and meta-analysis. And with that form, you can look at a paper and assess its quality in about 5 or 10 minutes. And so it's a great resource to be able to use. All right. A topic that all of you cared about this morning when you walked in here, urinary incontinence in women in Bangladesh. Who cares? That's the when I first saw the title of this paper, I was like, eh. And so what they did was, this has actually become one of my favorite papers in the last 5 years, and I'll tell you why in a second here. So basically what they were looking for was an exercise intervention in the management of urinary incontinence in older women in villages of Bangladesh. Now, in the culture of the south subcontinent, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, older women, probably not the highest priority of population for people to be caring about in their health systems. What they did was they found villages and they paired 16 villages, and each village was randomized. This village was randomized against this village for the treatment. So these are women 60 to 75 with urinary incontinence, without uterine prolapse. They're mobile, and they're, even though they're illiterate, they had the cognitive capacity to follow instructions. And villages were randomized to either exercise with education or just education about urinary incontinence alone. And that was 12 weeks for the group exercises. And so what this was not only teaching them about what urinary incontinence was and how to fight it, but there was someone actually doing pelvic floor exercise demonstrations with these women for 12 weeks for the group exercise, and then 24 weeks they did with home therapy. And the primary outcome was how many times were they incontinent in 3 days, and they assessed that every 4 weeks during this trial. How they assessed it, so you're following someone every 4 weeks to see how many episodes of urinary incontinence they had. How hard do you think that is to do? It would be really hard. Like, you know, how many of you have had a couple kids and you sneeze or laugh and a little bit happens and like you don't remember that the next day? But what they did was they gave these women a cord to tie on their sari, belt of their sari, and they're instructed every time they had urinary incontinence, they tied a knot in the string. So elegant. And so that they would collect these strings from these women at the end of those 4 weeks and assess how many episodes of urinary incontinence they had. But not only did they look at urinary incontinence, they used this scale called the EQ5. This is a quality of life index, basically, that's been used repeatedly around the world. And it's in many languages, and it even has a visual scale for illiterate people. And so what they found is that in the exercise plus education versus the education only group, there was a significant reduction in the amount of incontinence that women had. Again, I ask the question, especially for the guys sitting in the audience, who cares? But you think about the implication of this, right? You're smelling of urine. How much does that make you attractive to your male partner and just being in society in general in the marketplace? And I think the impact of this went on to show that the next thing that they looked at was just the improvement in the overall quality of life and well-being scale was also significantly improved. So not only were you reducing urinary incontinence, you're actually improving the quality of life in a real measurable way in the lives of these women. So a marked improvement in urinary incontinence, an improvement in their overall state of health. So to me, you know, as believers doing medical missions, that's something we care deeply about, right? Improving the quality of people's life existence with a very significant cost-effective model done in poor, rural, illiterate communities. And then for those of you who are doing primary care research in the global setting, the EQ5D is a really important scale to know about. What we don't know is whether this, how long these interventions lasted after the interventions were over. But yeah, I love this study for something that's a seemingly a minor issue, but had a significant impact on the lives of a lot of women.
So one of the amazing things about this study is that it was even done. This is a population that tends to be ignored. So there's 31 randomized controlled trials before this looking at pelvic floor exercises for incontinence, 31. 28 of them were done in high-income countries. 3 were done in upper-income countries. So this is the first one that was ever done in a low- and middle-income country looking at this intervention. And every single one of those 31 required people to travel to some urban area in order to receive the intervention. So this is also the first one that was ever done in a rural area. This has not even been done in a rural area in the U.S. So it's just wonderful that they did it done. The design that Jeff mentioned is incredible. And the at-risk population that could benefit from this is staggeringly large. So if you look, this... the intervention was in women above 60. But if you look at women, I think it was ages 30 to 59 in Bangladesh, 35% of them report that they have some of the issues that would get them to qualify for entry into this trial. And so it's just super important to look at these studies in the populations that we're actually trying to target, because we don't want to make assumptions that things that will work in one area will work in another. But we also don't want, we can't ignore these areas. So compared to the U.S. and other high-income countries where the other studies were doing, these women tend to marry earlier, start having children at younger ages, and their lifestyles tend to incorporate heavy lifting. What about if we looked at antenatal pelvic floor muscle training therapy? Because that has been studied in high-income countries and been shown to improve birth outcomes as well. So this is really just the tip of the iceberg for the opportunities that exist to go out there and just make absolutely huge differences for the half of the population that doesn't have our chromosomes. So this next study, saying, can four quarters get you more than a dollar? It was looking at using low doses, actually one quarter of the licensed starting dose of four different blood pressure medications as your initial therapy versus a single medication at the full dose. So this was done in Australia, double-blind, active control randomized trial. Adults with hypertension that were either untreated or on monotherapy. You can see the demographics there, mean age 59, 60% male, 82% white, and baseline blood pressure was not, it's 141 over 81, not 18. They used a quad pill of irbesartan, amlodipine, indapamide, and bisoprolol versus just the irbesartan. Follow-up at 12 weeks was the primary outcome. They did follow them out to a year. And if somebody needed an additional med, then they added on amlodipine 5 weeks at that six-week visit if they were not yet controlled. So at 12 weeks, 79% of the patients on the quad pill had achieved blood pressure control versus only 57% on the monotherapy. They had lower blood pressure there by around 7 millimeters of mercury. And tight control was improved as well. That was persistent out to a year. You still had about a 7, almost 8 millimeter of mercury decrease in their blood pressure with continued better rates of control as well as tight control. They looked at dizziness. Obviously, if we're starting multiple medications, we want to look at adverse events. And so the adverse events rates were similar, including dizziness, slightly higher, but did not quite meet statistical significance. And so in this study, the quarter dose quad pill was actually more effective for blood pressure control and seemed to be at least as safe as monotherapy.
So looking at all these numbers, it's kind of like mind-numbing. But my question for you is, I don't know, I was taught when we started someone on blood pressure medication, you start them on one med, you ramp them all the way up to the maximum dose, and then you start another med, and you ramp them all the way up to the maximum dose. But if you look at the doses in this quad pill, you can see there, you know, amlodipine 1.25 per milligrams and bisoprolol 2.5. These are tiny doses in the starting pill. And they're only using a quarter of this starting pill versus a full dose of a single therapy. So I think that's the one thing that's actually starting to come out, and that what we learned was wrong, that we should be actually starting low doses of multiple medications for high blood pressure versus taking one and ramping it all the way up to the maximum dose before we start another. So while I like that about this paper, the thing I don't like about this paper is that how many of you are familiar with the POEM versus DOE? Anyone hear those terms before? So POEMs are patient-oriented evidence that matters, and DOEs, or DOE, are disease-oriented evidence. So this is a disease-oriented evidence paper. So the outcomes are we lowered their blood pressure by 5 points. We lowered their blood sugar by 10 points. We some lab value, their potassium went up, whatever. I don't know that I care that much about those things. What I care about is, did they have less heart attacks? Did they have less strokes? Do they have real clinical outcomes that matter? And so whenever you pick up a paper to read it, What should be in your mind is this a poem or a doe? Is this patient-oriented evidence or is this disease-oriented evidence? Yeah.
What is the feasibility of getting that job?
You come on up and preach to the choir. You're right. So it's not a commercially available product. And so I think that there's a lot of work happening. There's a lot of work happening right now on trying to do combination poly pills of multiple things. There was just a paper published last month in Ghana looking at statins and aspirin and beta blockers and ACE inhibitors, trying to combine pills together to make it easier for people. So this is something that's theoretical to come going on. So this paper only looked at blood pressure lowering. So we can estimate from blood pressure lowering what kind of real-life outcomes we're going to get. I don't know that other than just me reminding myself that I probably need to be prescribing blood pressure medication differently than I was trained, that this is going to change my practice much.
So it's fascinating how they made the pill to make the placebo match. They actually used capsules. They took the commercially available pills, cut them up in quarters, and then put the little quarter fragments inside a capsule so that they couldn't tell that they were getting the four fragments versus the other one getting the full pill. But definitely not easily implementable at this point.
What was monotherapy?
Indipamide, I think. Irbesartan, yeah. 150 milligrams.
Can I have a question about that?
Yeah.
You said that if they weren't controlled in 6 weeks, they got amlodipine, but the end results didn't tell you how many in each group got the amlodipine.
It did, yeah. I ran out of room on the slides to get into all of it.
Presumably, or?
So there were very few people that were started on the quad pill needed anything added or modified, but there was a significant chunk. I think it was around a quarter to a third of the people who started on monotherapy then got put on double therapy.
I don't want to downplay this. I mean, it did lower people's blood pressure 8 millimeters of mercury using very tiny doses of antihypertensives. I mean tiny. And so I think it is. There's still something to be learned from this trial. The next question is the potential impact of midwives in preventing and reducing maternal and neonatal mortality and stillbirths. So this is a paper in Lancet Global Health, and if you like global health literature, Lancet Global Health is a tremendous journal that really publishes some really innovative international global health data. And so the question is, by ramping up the level of midwives in a country, can we reduce maternal and neonatal mortality in low- to middle-income countries? And if we can, if we do show that we're lowering mortality, why is that happening? Okay? And so this is a modeling study. This is not an intervention trial. And so there is this tool that we're going to talk about here in a second called the Lives Save tool. And this is a tremendous database online that I want you all to be aware of, and we'll talk about in a second, where it's just loaded with data put in from all kinds of governments and World Health Organization. It's sponsored by Johns Hopkins and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that you can go into and do any kind of modeling. If we had 10 more cardiologists in this country, what would happen to mortality? And so there's lots of different studies that you can use looking at this database. But they included 88 countries that were grouped into the lowest health of human development index, or to the group B was the 29 that were low to medium human development index, or group C was the next 29 countries on that list. And so they looked at four scenarios that they modeled with this. One is, if we do nothing, we know that we're going to lose some midwives. They estimated about 2% of midwives would stop practicing every 5 years. We increase 10% of midwives every 5 years, so a real modest increase, versus 25% more midwives every 5 years, versus universal coverage, whether we got 95% of all of our midwifery needs met. That was kind of the pie in the sky dream scenario. So these are all the groups that are involved with populating this database with data and also funding it. And this is LIST List. If you can play around if you're worried about, or if you're interested in global health research. So what did they find? They found if you did nothing, that's the bottom line, that actually more women would die, more babies would die, and there would be more stillbirths. Okay? And you would end up at the end of, by 2035, 1.7 more million deaths in the world, in these countries that they looked at. If you just did a modest increase, you could lower maternal deaths by 22%, neonatal deaths by 23%, that's the top row there, and save 1.3 million lives just by increasing the number of midwives 10% every 5 years. So that's a pretty modest thing. And you could see if you got 95% coverage, just dramatic, 4 million lives saved in 10 years. So this is huge, huge amount. Midwifery, adequate levels of midwifery can save a lot of lives, not just of moms, but of babies and stillbirths. The question is, if you're saving all these lives, what is the intervention that those midwives are doing that are actually saving these lives? And that's what these graphs are. I know that you can't see them, but what color? So the bottom graph there is maternal mortality, maternal deaths. The second from the bottom there is neonatal deaths, and the top is stillbirths. What color on those graphs do you see the most of? Blue. If you can read with really tiny eyes, you can see that blue is family planning education. So the things that these midwives were doing to save these 1.3 million lives, the vast majority of that impact came from family planning education. Do you need a midwife to do family planning education? No. We can be training community health workers to do a better job at doing family planning education, people with almost no education. And so we don't need midwives to actually make the vast majority of impact that they saw in this paper. So a couple reasons that I wanted to bring this out is, again, coming back to that theme of partnering with para-health professionals, midwives, and wondering how else we can be involved, but also just to bring to your awareness this list, this live save tools, a really helpful database if you're doing any kind of study in the global health world.
Are there any midwives here? Anyone involved with helping train midwives?
Okay.
A couple of hands, very good. So of these 88 countries that were included in here, those 88 countries account for 98% of maternal deaths in the world, 96% of neonatal deaths, and 95% of stillbirths that happen in the entire world happen in these 88 countries. Do you know how many of these 88 countries have active midwifery training programs? 4 out of the 88. So massive opportunities for investment and interventions that could make a huge difference where it's needed most. During my family medicine training, I got about half of my labor and delivery and OB training from certified nurse midwives. So I know that can happen in the U.S. We can work side by side. We can help build these training pipelines and work together, like Jeff was saying.
The other thing I'll mention is, you know, when I went to India to practice in a mission hospital, my model of healthcare-related missions was me going to take care of patients. And hopefully through these papers and this conference and many things at this conference, we're starting to shake that mentality that education and training of other people to help in that work can make a massive impact.
Can I ask what the family planning was? Were they giving contraception?
No, they were not giving contraception. They were talking about child spacing. They were making people aware of contraception that was available in their areas. But a lot of it was spacing of and just bringing the topic up with people. So this wasn't a trial. This was just looking at modeling. Right?
Yep, I should mention that. All right, looking at the duration of therapy for TB in kids, looking at 4 months versus 6 months, and this is a non-inferiority randomized control trial in Africa and India, looking at kids less than 16 with non-severe TB, the definition's there. Median age is 3.5 years old, 52% male, 11% were HIV positive, and they used the same initial 2-month intensive phase in both groups, which was a fixed dose combination of INH rifampin and pyrazinamide, plus or minus ethambutol. The continuation phase was 2 months in one group versus 4 months in the other. That was INH and rifampin. Before we go on to the results, I just want to quickly mention a difference between non-inferiority trials and superiority trials. So a lot of times when we learn about evidence-based medicine, we're just looking at superiority trials. And so we're used to, the alpha error is set at 5%, and that's a 5% chance that we say something is statistically significant, that it is effective, when in fact it is not. We're taking a 5% error of that. With a non-inferiority trial, that gets flipped around. And so the risk is that we say something is non-inferior when it's actually inferior. And the type 2 error is also different, where in a normal trial, you're failing to find a difference when there actually is one. And in this one, it would be saying that it's not inferior when it's actually superior. So things get flipped around. The other thing you have to look at is that center bar in the middle there. Each trial gets to determine what's our non-inferiority margin. And so you've got to look at that when you're analyzing the trial to figure out, is that actually a reasonable margin that we're putting in? But these are becoming more and more common because as you have effective treatments, it's unethical usually to do a trial compared to placebo. So you're having to compare a new treatment to one that has theoretically been proven to be effective. So in this trial, 95% were retained, 94% were adherent by their definition. The primary outcome was looking at unfavorable status at 72 weeks, which was a treatment failure change, loss to follow-up, TB recurrence, or death. And 4 months or 6 months had equivalent outcomes. If anything, the 4 months was 0.3% better with the risk difference, although that wasn't statistically significant. And adverse effects were also similar. So from this, we can conclude that in children with non-severe TB, 4 months of treatment is non-inferior to 6 months of treatment.
How many of you are involved with TB treatment? The difference between 4 months of therapy and 6 months of therapy is massive. And so if this is true, being able to reduce the duration of treatment in a kid from 6 months to 4 months is groundbreaking. The ability to follow people up and the effort that it takes in these TB treatment programs. And so this is a really excellent. The only problem with this that made it a little less applicable to very, very impoverished settings is that they had to have a chest x-ray to determine whether or not they were severe TB or not severe TB. So that may not be applicable to a lot of very low resource settings. So we just to be in mind of that. But this study has been repeated a couple times. Sometimes they're using fluoroquinolones, which we're not really a fan of using at the first line for TB. But just to know that this is out there, if you end up in a TB country like India or many places in Africa, that for pediatric patients, 4 months is possibly as good as six. All right, we're almost ending the end here, so we're going to liven things up a little bit. Drones to deliver blood in rural Rwanda. So the question is, if we have a blood bank everywhere that we need to have a blood bank to make blood accessible for trauma patients and for maternal hemorrhages and everything else, you're having all these stockpiles of blood around the country that are expiring then faster. And if we could put all this blood in one or two centralized locations and deliver it with drones, could we make a significant difference? And so this was data collected in Rwanda from 20 health facilities over 5 years. And most of this blood was transfused into kids who had malaria or women who had OB bleeding. But some were also from road traffic accidents, which was the leading cause of mortality in Rwanda. And so what they did was they compared how long did it take to get blood to these places by road versus by drone, and what were the delivery times. And so they kind of looked at that, and then they also looked at how much blood is going bad and expiring before we ever give it to a patient. And so what they found out was of all of the blood orders, there were 12,700 blood product orders delivered by drones in this period of time in 2 years, 2.5 years. Almost half of them were emergency orders, and they were delivered by drones to 20 different facilities. The mean delivery time by a drone was almost 50 minutes versus 120 minutes if they sent it by car. And the time savings, obviously it varied all around there because they're different distances. Sometimes it was as little as 3 minutes saved, but sometimes it was as much as three or four hours saved. And they'd reduce the amount of blood going bad by 67%. So they're wasting a lot less blood in this. I mean, just amazing that someone out in rural Rwanda is starting to think about how we can use a drone to deliver. And you think of then the application of this, right? It's not just for blood, but from antibiotics or for... And what we're not talking about is this. This is a picture of the drone that was used. And so these are huge things with refrigeration units in them. So Philip's such a geek. That's his drone. And he's just been waiting for a week to do that. But again, this is a disease-oriented outcome. We're looking at times, and we're looking at blood product expiration, which are important. But what we'd really like to see are we actually saving lives by delivering blood. But you can do it. I think the thing is that you can do it. And you think about like rare antibiotics, you think about heart valves, you think about organ transplants, you think about the capacity in very rural areas to be able to deliver things by drones is significant. And instead of using them in wars and to bomb people, to use them to deliver life-saving treatment is also a pretty cool thing to think about.
Yeah, so if you want to get on YouTube and waste a whole lot of time, just Google drone blood delivery in Rwanda, and you can learn a lot about how they're doing it. But you can see this is a hefty drone. It's a fixed wing. They had to come up with a special way to get it to land, that they use this kind of hook that connects and it swings under. It's all modular, so they get the blood order delivered to the central location, and within a few minutes, they have a drone assembled, they've got the blood packed, they've got it loaded on, and they launch this thing off of that slingshot. It then flies to the destination in an automated way. They worked with air traffic control to set up specific routes, and then it drops the blood via parachute in a refrigerated box that then lands in a designated area at the hospital. So, super cool. Like Jeff said, it's not patient-oriented evidence at this point. But for a small country like Rwanda, they can cover the entire country from just two bases. And what they're looking at in larger countries is actually setting up a network where you might have a central location. This drone is able to fly out to its range. It lands. Then you put that package in another drone that can then get it even further so you can expand the footprint. So very cool. I'm glad that they actually tried to study it. Like, even though it's disease-oriented evidence, they're going about it in a scholarly way to try to prove that this is actually change that represents improvement, not just something that's cool and gets nerds excited, but actually does make a difference. So applaud them for doing that.
The last thing my teachers in residency and medical school pounded into my head this disease-oriented evidence versus patient-oriented evidence. I will just say that you never find a patient-oriented evidence trial that didn't have multiple disease-oriented evidence trials done beforehand. Mm-hmm. So don't discard disease-oriented evidence. That has to come first.
And my wife donates blood a lot. I would say, from her perspective, it's patient-oriented if her blood doesn't go to waste. So she would appreciate that aspect of the outcome.
No, there was not a cost-effectiveness study. That was another weakness of this trial. I think I had that on there. But, yeah, they did not do cost analysis of this.
All right, last trial. This is the 10th one, looking at iron interventions in infants in low- and middle-income countries. So lots of evidence that anemia and iron deficiency anemia are associated with multiple adverse outcomes. And so this trial was trying to see if iron supplementation improved functional outcomes. So it was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial in Bangladesh, 8-month-old infants. You can see all the inclusion and exclusion criteria there, including areas where there was a lot of iron in the groundwater, and so they were getting that. So they only looked at areas that had low iron in the groundwater. It was actually a double dummy trial, so there's three arms with an iron syrup, a micronutrient powder, and placebo, and then they had placebo, syrup, and powder. So everybody was getting syrup and powder every single time that they were taking a dose so that they didn't know which of the three arms they were in. The primary outcome was a cognitive composite score at 3 months after the intervention. And like I mentioned before, it's important to know what the size of the scale was. So this one ranges from a score of 55 to 145. And the difference between groups, none of which were statistically significant, were a quarter to a half a point. So really, no significant changes in the cognitive outcomes. And the differences were even smaller at 9 months of follow-up. So no statistically significant difference at 3 months, even smaller differences at 9 months. But if you looked at the secondary outcomes, the anemia significantly improved and the iron deficiency significantly improved with the active intervention. So this was, I put ineffective with an asterisk because it was effective at fixing the anemia and the iron deficiency. Unfortunately, it did not seem to make a difference for any of the cognitive outcomes.
Yeah, to me, this is helpful because there's a lot of analogies with this in United States. You know, low vitamin D levels are associated with all kinds of really bad things, falls and everything else, but there's very little evidence that supplementing with vitamin D changes any of those things. And so then you start to wonder about the cognitive impairment with anemia. Is there something else going on that's possibly causing that cognitive impairment? Now, we certainly care about improving anemia levels in kids, and so we're not discarding this trial. But I think it's important to know that it's important now for future studies and things to be thinking about. If you're doing a countrywide program or your whole Mission Hospital catchment area of doing iron supplementation, hoping to improve cognitive, you know, the downstream things from anemia, including cognitive impairment, you're not going to do that, giving iron to these kids. And so it's just important to know what your goals are. I'll cut that short because we have 5 minutes left. Yeah, go ahead.
Just the there's multiple contributors.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's, yeah, to think about all the things that are contributing to poor cognitive performance in these kids, it's bigger than just iron, right? So, all right, we have 5 minutes left. We were supposed to leave 15 minutes for questions. Any questions about any of this? Yeah.
That seems like the most likely mechanism, yeah.
So if I think about the papers that I did and think about common themes, for me, and I think the applicability for this crowd or people who are going to be practicing healthcare-related missions is use resources other than the doctors working in your mission hospital, right? And there is so much impact that can happen by using midwives, community health workers, drone operators. And so we're going to make a bigger impact for health if we don't just see us taking care of one patient at a time.
The question was about the mechanism underlying aspirin's reduction in preterm birth. And so thought that was reductions in severe preeclampsia then led to the reductions in preterm birth.
Thank you for your presentation. I really enjoyed this. As I was listening to it, I was thinking about
the goal for these papers was just to jog your imaginations and to think about ways outside of the box. But you're exactly right. You know, applying any one of these to a particular setting may be challenging. But most of these were cost-effective things that can be done. And I think the one thing is also just realizing that what we learned from our time in India, that if you're the mission hospital trying to do this all by yourself, you're probably going to get very limited traction. You got to be partnering with government health systems and doing what you can in those settings as well. So, any other questions, comments? Yeah.
Just a quick comment. You know, the first do no harm. Iron is a toxin, and so
yes,
at the time, like with prenatal vitamin D, iron, and so forth, it can be the leading cause of poisonings for children. So, if you don't see a benefit, you sure as heck don't want that in the house.
Yeah. Good point. You know, this reminds me of all the treatment, you know, the huge blank blanketing villages with albendazole to treat worms, because we knew that worms caused anemia, which caused cognitive impairment. And I don't think any of those studies, the initial studies did show improvement, but overall, I think as they've gotten better quality of studies, that's not shown to have an impact in cognitive performance in kids. So, yeah, that's debatable. Some people feel passionately about that, so I shouldn't have mentioned that. All right, any other comments? Good. We'll be around here if you want, but thank you for being attentive.